oil for gold is an inevitability.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of our interview with macro analyst Luke Groman. If you haven't yet watched part one of this discussion with Luke, in which he explains why the fast rising cost to service the U.S. federal debt, along with a recent drop in tax receipts, are causing the national deficit to balloon and may likely be the trigger that forces the Federal Reserve to pivot its policy, head over to our channel at youtube.com/Wealthion and watch it there first. It sets the context for the investment themes we discuss in this video. Luke's also generously shares how he recommends allocating capital for the turbulent times he sees ahead, so be sure to stick around to hear that. Okay, let's get started watching part two of our interview with Luke Groman. Let's trundle over into the market outlook side of things. So if I take anything from what you've said so far, it's lots of uncertainty going into next year and highly dependent upon if and when the Fed pivots here. So for the capital managers, you know, fund managers who are stewarding lots of capital, as well as just for the individual investor, the folks that are watching, you know, this program, it's a hard year to say, man, how do I position myself going in here? What is your general market outlook for 2023? Does the bear market that started this year, does it continue? Do we see new lows next year or different ballgame?
I think the first quarter to half of next year are going to be tough. And I think you'll see a resumption of that, the regime that we saw through, you know, February through, call it September of this year.
Where higher dollar, higher rates, everything else down.
Yeah. Because again, it's the tax receipt picture combined with the lagged impact of rates is going to force, you have a balance of payments problem in the reserve currency issue of the world, full stop. And that if the reserve currency has a balance payment problem, everybody has a balance payments problem. So I think my baseline view at this point is you get sort of markets down in the first 3 to 4 months of the year. And at some point that forces something somewhere to break in a big enough way that the Fed has to pause. And then I think we sort of take off. I think you see CPI continue to kind of come down. I don't think it ever gets back to 2 or 3. I think it probably bottoms at 4, 5, 6, and the Fed's going to have to reaccelerate into that. And I think by the end of next year, I think you could see stocks recover what they lose in early in the year and maybe even get back to all-time highs. But I think it's going to be accompanied by inflation that is probably also new 40-year highs, high singles, low double digits in the United States. And I think within good stock market, I think you've got a vicious sector rotation within that, because if CPI is running, you know, 8 to 10, you don't need to pay 30, 40 times earnings for some high growth name. You can, you know, U.S. Steel is going to be growing earnings faster than that and trading for a much lower multiple. Oil companies, industrial companies, I think you'll see a vicious sector rotation to sort of the, you know, to borrow from early in my career, new economy to old economy, markets overall higher, inflation higher as we exit 2023. But that's my baseline view, is sort of weak to start, Fed pivot, you know, something breaks, Fed pivot, and then, you know, way a off to the races kind of a thing with a vicious sector rotation that is already sort of underway, really sort of being reinforced.
Okay. I'm going to congratulate you for being in good company. I'm going to presume you hadn't have a chance to watch it yet, but that outlook to me sounds quite similar to what Felix Zuloff shared.
Is that right? Yeah, I did not watch that. So that is that's pretty flattering. Yeah, that's
You should go watch that. And let me repeat a little bit of what you said and what Felix said to see exactly how much overlap there is. He agrees with you that pretty much everything's going to go down in Q1-ish or so. So it'll be a replay of what we saw for much of 2022, like you said. He then thinks there's going to be an event that will force a pivot. Like you, he sees inflation coming down in that initial period, and then
really taking off over the next couple of years and hitting new highs, which I know is depressing for everybody to hear. He thinks that there's going to be, you know, some assets that perform very well sort of instantly upon the announcement of the pivot, right? So that'll be bonds, particularly, you know, sovereign bonds will react very well, especially the long dated ones. So he thinks that there'll be a nice 6 to 9 month period for bonds following the announcement of the pivot news. And like precious metals, you know, those will respond really quickly too. He thinks that stocks will take longer to recover, which history shows when there's been a pivot and, you know, in a bear market, it does usually take stocks a quarter or two to get their mojo back. He imagines that you'll see the first response in the high growth stocks, the tech sector stocks, one, because they've been so beaten up, and two, because that's sort of where hot money tends to flood initially. But then, like you, he sees it relatively quickly rotating it into more sort of the cyclical, the industrials, and like you, expects that they're going to do pretty well in and of themselves. He thinks probably more than anything else, commodities are going to fare best. And from his perspective, and his outlook might go a little further in the years, he thinks that the bull market run in stocks will probably go through the end of 2024. And he thinks it's going to be pretty big, like almost like a doubling from whatever low the pivot happens from. So he says that doubling to get people's attention, like this is not going to be a little recovery. It's going to be a big one. He thinks commodities could run into 2025. Then he thinks that the wheels just come off everything. We go into like a big depression that's caused by this high inflation, whatnot, in 2025 and beyond. And I'm not going to ask you to opine that far into the future. We'll have you back on this program many times long before. But how much does that outlook agree with kind of your crystal ball at this point?
I think it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I could see bonds rallying. I mean, they have rallied a little bit. I could see them rallying mechanically with the weaker dollar. I mean, you can see as the dollar has strengthened, FX hedged treasury yields have been very negative for European and Japanese investors. So to the extent you weaken the dollar, you're going to improve mechanically foreign buying of treasuries. I think it's a suboptimal way to play the pivot. I think you'll make money, but I don't think the 10-year is going from whatever 3.6 to, you know, one again or two, right? I think it, you know, goes from 3.6 to 3.25 to 3. There's money to be made there, but I think things like gold, Bitcoin, commodities will be a much more optimal expression of that pivot trade. You know, in other words, yeah, I think bonds probably go up, but I think gold over TLT keeps rising. I think copper over TLT rises. I think silver over TLT rises. I think, you know, oil over TLT rises. So I think it's just all relative. But a lot of what he says, I think makes a lot of sense. I would tend to agree and certainly defer to someone with his experience.
Yeah, he's not a guy you want to bet against often.
No, he's crazy.
But that being said, you know, nobody has a guaranteed lock on what's going to happen in the future, and I value your opinions just as much. All right. So you mentioned a few things that I got to ask you about as we begin to wrap up here. One is gold. So you think gold will do well from the pivot news alone. There's been some interesting articles written recently about talk about oil potentially being priced in gold. Zoltan Poznar has recently proposed this, and you've done some writing about this, how it could even be done, even if there isn't a direct pricing of oil and gold, that, you know, sort of using the Shanghai exchanges, you could basically affect this exchange anyways, right? So can you just talk about the likelihood of gold becoming a real primary currency for something like oil?
I think it's already begun on some level. I mean, if you look since 3Q14, foreign central banks have sold $370 billion of treasury bonds on net, and they've bought about $300 billion in gold on net in that same time. So it's been one of the most quiet trends in sort of macro, in my view, and continues to be. To me, oil for gold is an inevitability for a number of reasons. Number one, if you are an oil exporter, And Putin gave us a detailed speech about this in June. And of course, it was ignored in the Western media because it was Putin and whatever. If you were an oil exporter, you are seeing peak cheap energy all over. You're seeing depleting oil wells. You are seeing energy. The cost to replace oil reserves is rising inexorably everywhere. So if you're an oil exporter, you sell oil, you run a surplus, where do you put those surpluses? Do you put them in sovereign debt, which we just discussed cannot be kept money good on a nominal basis unless real rates are negative? You would have to be an idiot to take negative real interest rates on your sovereign debt, particularly when your primary export oil has to rise in terms of those bonds just to keep production flat. So at some point, oil exporters get motivated to shift into a reserve asset that can rise in price and keep them, you know, on par. And if you look over since 1870, in 1870, an ounce of gold is 24 barrels an ounce. Today, it's 22 barrels an ounce, right? So there's gold holds its value in oil, period. In contrast, U.S. Treasuries in 1946, $1,000 face value U.S. Treasury bought you 100 barrels of oil, give or take, and now it buys you 16. Sovereign debt collapses against oil, give or take. That's just since 1970 or 75. So the exporters are motivated to store surplus in something that preserves the real value, the oil real value of their wealth, of their surpluses. Same time, your energy short oil importers, your energy short creditor oil importers, right? So your Chinas, your Japans, your Europes, your Indias, they're looking at this going, we can see what happens when oil goes up. We saw it this year. What happens? Japan goes into not just from a current account surplus, they go into a current account deficit. What happens to the yen? It crashes. Europe goes from being current account surplus into current account deficit because oil goes up. What happens to the euro? Crashes. You get into this dynamic where they have the same motivation from the other side as, and oh, by the way, this isn't just Europe and Japan and India and China. This is Ghana and this is Turkey and this is all these emerging markets around the world. They are running current account surpluses. When energy pushes them into a deficit, into a current account deficit, the currencies collapse. They have to sell dollars to buy energy, or they have to cut energy purchases. They go into a currency crisis. So how do they prevent this from happening? It's the same dynamic. They need to buy energy in their own currency. Except they don't want to issue debt. They don't want to run the same model as the US, which is buy energy in our currency and then just take our bonds, because that means you have to offshore all of your manufacturing, and none of them want to do that. So what they have to settle in something, though. Some of them will settle in goods, but there will still be net left over. What do you settle in? Well, nobody trusts anybody else, so everybody wants gold. So you're coming at it from sort of the same way in both directions. And I think what Zoltan wrote, that, you know, it's fascinating. You see a number of commentators who love everything he has to say about money markets, and he's brilliant. And then he says this, and it really is a money market balance of payments issue. And they completely dismiss it because the word gold's in it. So they just, their heads explode. I think gold for oil is an inevitability. I think it's already underway on some level. Now, where it gets really interesting is if you are, you can use it to manage your balance of payments, right? If you're Ghana, like where Ghana just came out and said, we're going to barter oil for gold 2 weeks ago. Well, implied in all of this is that the price of paper gold is manipulated, right? It's overstated. There's a huge pile of unallocated gold claims centered in London relative to the available underlying physical. That's how we manage the gold price. Not particularly, some quarters it's controversial, but I don't think it's particularly controversial throughout
the world. And just to be clear, you meant the supply is overstated by the paper market, not the price.
Sorry. Yes. Excuse me. Yes. Exactly. So if you're Ghana, right, you're in one of two things. You have two issues. The dollar has gone up. So your dollar debt has gone up, the cost to service your dollar debt, and your dollar oil cost has gone up. So how do you manage your dollar availability? You're having a dollar crisis, you're a liquidity crisis. The more the dollar goes up, the more they're going to be incented to do this, which is, if they can barter gold for oil, they can go to Russia and say, listen, we'll see, you know, we'll do the deal with you. Except we're not going to, let's not do it at, you know, the COMEX, you know, gold to oil ratio, right? Gold on COMEX, oil on NYMEX. The COMEX NYMEX gold to oil ratio is wherever it is today, 22, say it's 22 barrels per ounce. Ghana can go to Russia and go, listen, we'll give you 25 barrels per ounce, right? Let us buy it 25 barrels an ounce. Let's value the gold up. So now Ghana can, in theory, go, you know, and short oil at the 22 barrels an ounce and on NYMEX, buy gold, take the gold, take it to Russia, get 25 barrels of oil, bring the 25 barrels back, recover the short of the 22, have 3 barrels left over. And now all of a sudden, their dollar drain from their energy imports can be managed by the ratio of gold to oil. And the more the dollar goes up, the more this is going to incent not just Ghana, but everybody to do some version of this trade, because it's in everybody's national security interest not to economically collapse because bad things happen to the politicians. So I think he is on, I think Zoltan is on to something. I don't think a former Fed and Treasury official writes something like this lightly. And I think it is in the world we are in, where you have the combination of peak cheap energy and a global sovereign debt bubble, I think oil for gold is an inevitability, because no one's going to want to take the paper that has to be in negative real rates just to prevent sovereign default. And peak cheap energy in the meantime means the cost of energy keeps going up. So the real value of that paper in energy terms keeps falling over time. So those two factors, peak cheap energy plus global sovereign debt bubble, it, to me, makes oil for gold inevitable. And I think we're just in the very, very early innings of seeing that happen. And I think as that gains momentum, I think it's really, really good for gold over time. And it's not to say, oh, it's going to go up X by 6 months from now. I don't know. But we know, I don't have to speculate, we know what central banks are doing with their gold holdings. They're selling treasuries. They're buying gold. They've been doing so for 8 to 9 years.
Right. But it's just, that's so fascinating. And, you know, I guess, put simply, if the petrodollar regime gets replaced with the gold for oil regime, I mean, that would just be a massive long-term tailwind at the back of gold, amongst all the other reasons to own it.
Oh my gosh. And again, it has to, because if you are an oil importing, if you're China, and you store your money in treasuries, and the price of oil, you know, your interest rate is negative relative to oil, your ability to buy oil in dollars deteriorates over time, which means your potential growth of your economy deteriorates over time. Well, you've got all that debt to service. You can't afford that. Russians have the same problem. The Europeans have the same problem. The Japanese, they all have the same problem. The flip side, you know, like I said, the producer side, if you're the Russians, listen, you produce a bunch of oil today, but in 10 years, 15 years, your oil depletes. And now, once Russia's oil depletes, we know what happens to oil prices. If we came out tomorrow, we came in tomorrow and said, Russia can't produce any more oil, what happens to the price of oil? It triples probably overnight, doubles overnight. Well, if Russia has exchanged prior oil supplies for treasuries, and then the price of oil doubles, so now Russia's got to go buy back that oil that they sold before, that now costs twice the money. That's not a good trade for them. They need, if oil is depleting at all, they need to hold their wealth in something that's going to preserve purchasing power in oil terms. If it came out tomorrow and Russia's out of oil, like, oil's going to double and gold's going to double. You know, oil's going to go up a bunch, but treasuries aren't going to, treasuries aren't going to, you know, double from here. They have to, as a matter of national security, store reserves in something to preserve purchasing power in oil terms, or they need to find a new energy source, right? So that's where the fusion stuff that we just got,
right,
changes things potentially. But presuming that's not commercialized in the next few years, peak cheap oil and the global sovereign debt bubble make oil for gold an inevitability, in my view.
Yeah, and just to that point of the presumption, I mean, I think, so we're referring to the headlines that just came out literally yesterday about a potentially important milestone in nuclear fusion research. But under the rosiest of scenarios, you know, if everything goes perfectly well, we're still many decades away from commercialization of this. So peak cheap oil is going to have its day, sadly, whether we like it or not, before fusion rides to the rescue.
So this is an overly simplified comment, but what I'm taking away from what you're saying, Luke, I know you and Brent Johnson spent a lot of time going back and forth on Twitter. To a certain extent, you can almost look at gold as the pressure release to the dollar milkshake problem that the rest of the world faces, right? That as it gets more and more injured by a rising dollar, in the secular grind, gold becomes the escape hatch where it says, "Wow, the more I can actually settle in gold, it solves a lot of these problems."
It's very paradoxical or ironic, yeah, that the stronger the dollar goes, the more you're going to push people into gold and away from treasuries,
Okay.
paradoxically.
One interesting little mental exercise I'll just encourage folks to do, because I know we have a lot of precious metal holders that watch this program, is there are 31, a little over 31 grams in a troy ounce of gold. So if you have a gold coin and pull it out, I could hold it easily in my hand here. That would be worth, if we're talking a gram for a barrel of oil, I assume oil is traded in 55-gallon drum, more or less. Is that the size of
I
the
think
oil
that's right.
fields?
Yeah, I think it's 55-gallon drum.
Yeah. So in my office here that I shoot this stuff in, there's no way I could fit 55-gallon oil drums in here. And I can imagine what I could do with all that oil in terms of how that would power my lifestyle for a good long time, all packed into, the storage unit of this little gold coin, right? So to, you were sort of saying all the benefits of this on a national basis, but I think it's useful to even think about it that way in our lives, right? Would you like to have the stored value and energetic potential of 55, oil drums? And a lot of people be like, yeah, great. And you could store it in a very easy, fungible, easy to sell, easy to store unit, like a coin. Absolutely, right? So I don't know, I just found that a very useful mental exercise to go through. Okay, right before we wrap up here, because you mentioned it, you did mention Bitcoin earlier. I know that Bitcoin and gold have been assets that you have both encouraged people to have some ownership in. I'm just curious if your investment thesis in Bitcoin has been impacted materially in any way by both its poor performance in 2022 when we had high inflation, right? Because my read of the Bitcoin market is that they've kind of given up mostly on it's going to be a currency that's going to be a competing currency with the dollar. So don't worry about the currency part of it. But the store of value is really the big part of it. And it has not performed very well as a store of value this year. So that's development number one. Development number two, obviously, has been the recent FTX scandal, which isn't Bitcoin specific, but it has shaken some people's confidence in the whole cryptoverse. So I'm curious, has either of those impacted your outlook on Bitcoin?
The short answer is no. For me, Bitcoin is trading like gold did in Weimar Germany. There were four or five separate instances between 1918 and 1923 when the Reichsmark hyperinflated to zero against gold that people were selling gold to buy German Reichsmarks because, hey, they implemented austerity. They were, the Reichsbank was raising rates. They're going to defend the currency. And in the end, the fiscal situation governs. And I look at, I've said multiple times, Bitcoin is the last functioning smoke detector. And I think it's still functioning in that way. Bitcoin crashed in, if we remember, early December last year, right around this time. Like $15,000 in a day. And I remember looking and going, And then you started seeing problems in the euro dollar market right around that same time, implying dollar tightness. And so to me, I as I told clients back in June, like at the time I had sold in June of 21, I sold most of my Bitcoin and paid off my house. That was a pretty good inflation hedge. Thank you, Fed. At around $50,000. Now, unfortunately, I've been buying it all the way down since, and that's been suboptimal. But in terms of its read, I don't think there's any change to that of I think what Bitcoin's telling us by being where it is first half of next year is probably not going to be good because it's just a liquidity metric. I think it's probably being weighed on to a certain degree by liquidation, et cetera, associated with the various crypto stuff. And for me, I wouldn't really do anything with the other stuff. I would focus on Bitcoin and I would focus on custodying it yourself. I think that, you know, I think what the FTX, what we've seen with FTX should be telling people custody your own Bitcoin, number one, but it should be telling people custody your own gold. It should be telling, broadly speaking, if you don't hold it, you don't own it. So I think there's some pretty broad lessons there overall, but no, it has not changed my view in one bit. I think Bitcoin will do really well when the Fed is forced by the fiscal situation to resume financing U.S. deficits.
Okay, great. All right. So you would, I imagine you would advise buying at these prices here and then obviously holding a cold storage solution, not on an exchange, and then expecting that if the Fed does pivot, then that should revitalize.
I think it will. I mean, it's like I said, I've been buying it back too soon after selling it in mid 21. You know, it is what it is. But to me, I think it remains sort of the last functioning smoke detector.
Okay, good. And that is a sign of your conviction, the fact that you've been buying in. Okay, great. Well, Luke, this has been yet another wonderful conversation. I love having you on the program. I'd love to have you back on again at some point in Q1 to give us an update on where things are and make any audible adjustments based upon what we're seeing on the playing field. Then for folks that have really enjoyed this conversation, would like to follow you and your work, where should they go?
You can check us out at our website, fftt-llc.com, and then they can find us on Twitter at Luke Groman, LukeGroMen.
All right, awesome. And when we edit this, Luke, I will put up those URLs on the screen too, so it's really excellent. Easy for folks to know where to go. All right, well, Luke, it's been a pleasure. Really hope to have you on again soon, but thanks so much again.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for your time, Adam. It was great talking.
Well, all right. Well, now is the time in the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the endorsed financial advisory firms by Wealthion, to react to what Luke and I talked about and also talk about what the markets have been up to in the past week. I'm joined as usual by John Lodra and Mike Preston. Hey guys, John, why don't we start with you? I know a lot of what Luke mentioned there must be pretty consistent with your guys' outlook as I know it at New Harbor, but what were your key takeaways?
Yeah, thank you, Adam, and great to be back with you. I'll try to give a quick flyby, and I'm sure Mike and I can, along with you, go deeper into some of the big picture themes. Luke talked about, he kind of framed where we likely are in his assessment of the economic and market cycle of being in the sixth inning of probably continued playing out of the trends and dynamics we've seen in 2022, which has basically been higher rates, persistently high, though maybe declining inflation as we are on the heels of yesterday's slightly, and I'll emphasize slightly, better than expected consensus inflation forecast. He thinks we're probably going to see a continuation of that dynamic into the first quarter, first half of 2023. And perhaps that's met with a more pronounced market sell-off and economic slowing. To bring us closer to the ninth inning, to use his baseball analogy. He did highlight some of the fiscal situations going on, particularly in the U.S. With, you know, tax receipts falling increasingly short of spending obligations and commitments. I think he projected that on the current path, we're likely to see tax receipts at only 60% of needs, and that was up, that would be up from about 30% of this year. So a growing shortfall from a fiscal standpoint in the U.S. The implications that would have for maybe a forced Fed hand or letting the market have to price in some of the borrowing pressures that the U.S. will likely face. He did talk about the Fed remittances, not surprisingly, suddenly being vastly below the history. You know, typically the Fed is as a first and foremost, they pay a dividend to bank shareholders. That's their first obligation. But any surpluses that the Fed runs need to get remitted to the U.S. Treasury. And for the longest time in history, the Fed would have positive remittances to the Treasury. The last several months to a year or so, that has absolutely fallen off a cliff. So there's been a very massive shortfall. Not a surprise given all the stimulus and whatnot, but...
Right. And to be clear, it's not a shortfall in remittances. It's actually now taken money out of the treasury, right?
Well, yeah, basically that, you know, and to add a little color to that, which perhaps will incite some ire on the folks of listeners, is this is all in a backdrop where the Fed is paying very substantial amounts, billions every month to banks in the form of what's called interest on excess reserves. Now, these are literally payments made by the Fed to park basically depositors' deposits at the Fed, and the banks get a windfall, essentially interest on excess reserves. And most banks aren't sharing that in the form of higher deposit interest rates. So at the very least, we would encourage folks to, you know, be a little angry, but also vote with your feet. Put your money in things like treasury bills, where you're going to get a decent yield, not a bank account where you're getting 20 or 30 basis points, 0.2 or 0.3% if you're lucky.
Yeah. Six basis points at my savings account.
Yeah, I mean, it's really unconscionable. And thankfully, investors can vote with their feet very easily. Open a Treasury Direct account, work with an advisor who can buy Treasury bills for you for at least your cash holdings, like we do all the time for clients in this environment. And, you know, I'll touch upon a couple other things. You know, he did talk about, and you prompted this, the likelihood of a dollar, you know, kind of pinning of things like resources, gold, oil into things like real assets and gold. And, you know, we'll talk about those, I think, in much more detail. But that was kind of the big picture that I'd like to reiterate from what I took away from Luke's comments.
All right. And Mike, I'm coming to you in a sec. But real quick, John, one thing that Luke mentioned that I think is just important we all be aware of is you were talking about tax receipts coming down and it's increasing basically the deficit that we have to make up for. He also mentioned that a third of the current federal debt is set to reprice within the year, right? So what's the federal debt right now? It's over $31 trillion. I know that, right? And so, you know, that's over $10 trillion that is going to go, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I'm going to guess from somewhere down close to one-ish or two, you know, that's going to reprice somewhere around four. That's just a tremendous amount of additional interest expense that's going to be making that deficit even worse with the falling tax receipts.
Yeah, the math is pretty simple when you look at it at a macro level. And if you looked at a household balance sheet in the same manner, you'd say, wow, this household's in big trouble. Of course, the Fed, through its money creation, can stay solvent, even though it's bleeding. And that has consequences in terms of devaluation of the currency, spurring inflation, or maybe making inflation a more intractable thing than yesterday's, you know, again, very modest surprise to the positive side. You know, you're not going to have inflation kind of go back down to 2% or zero if you start to monetize the debt like the Fed has done over the last decade or so.
All right. So Mike, coming to you, anything else you want to add to what John said? Maybe I'll cede your answer a little bit and just reemphasize the similarities I heard between Luke's outlook and Felix Zuloff's outlook, who we had on this channel relatively recently. But what else do you take away?
Yeah, I mean, there was just some talk there about tax receipts declining rapidly. Really, the reason tax receipts exploded over the last bunch of years is because the Fed blew the biggest bubble we've really ever seen in modern times, probably the biggest bubble in our lifetimes. And now all of that is reversing. And Luke talked about the fact that the Federal Reserve is down about $1 trillion to $1.2 trillion on their balance sheet, which is over $10 trillion in terms of treasuries they hold. So they've lost on paper $1 to $1.2 trillion in U.S. citizens' money, and they don't really have to report that. They don't have to mark that to market. They carry it forward, as Luke said, as a deferred asset. And really, we're just in this game where everybody is game theorizing the Fed, and everything we continue to talk about is the Fed, because that's all that matters so far. And it's only mattered that way for a long time.
You know, yeah, hey, sorry to interrupt, Mike, but I should mention here, we're recording this on Wednesday, December 14th, and in like 15 minutes,
the Fed's going to release its latest statement in terms of its policy measures for December. Yeah. And then Powell's going to talk after that. Unfortunately, we're not going to know all the reaction to that by the time we're done recording here. But to your point, once again, the world is sitting on pins and needles with bated breath, waiting to see what one single entity is going to do. And that is going to drive the price action from here.
It's all that matters. It's the final decision from the Fed comes out today in just a little while. And by the time this video is released, I think we'll all know. The technicals of the market are such that we're very concerned about the progressing bear market, but it's been a very controlled and slow descent. We really haven't seen any trap doors open to the downside. That's what we're concerned about. Whether or not this Fed announcement will be a catalyst or something else could be a catalyst, or maybe that move lower comes further down the road, we don't know. But surprises should be to the downside in what we think is a structural bear market, a true bear market. So going back to the Fed balance sheet for a minute, over $1 to $1.2 trillion in losses, that's taxpayer money. This constant Fed intervention hopefully comes to an end at some point. I don't think it's going to happen voluntarily, because Luke said something in there about, well, do you really want to be at the helm and blow up the financialized U.S. economy? Because it'll mean it's just a horrible time for us. It'll be a recession, depression even, and nobody wants to be at the helm of that and be culpable for that type of crash. But at the same time, it's being used as an excuse to continue the same policies that have a lot of negative effects. The negative effects being the Fed gets to choose who gets the purchasing power and the wealth and who doesn't. And namely, those are the people that own the assets. So we'll see. I think Luke's right. I think the first half of 23 is going to be to the downside. I think we are probably in the sixth inning, if that. And we see much lower markets in the first half of 23. So we'll see what happens.
All right, John, heading back to you to, you know, Luke's point about being in the sixth inning of the global sovereign debt crisis. Right before we turned the cameras on here, you were telling me about another notable veteran investor who feels like we're at a sea change moment. Do you just want to give a little more color on that?
Sure. I want to correct one thing I said earlier, though. I mentioned Luke threw out a stat of tax receipts only covering maybe 60% of spending. What I meant, what the actual stat was, is 60% of GDP growth. So, in a world where you can grow GDP more than the fiscal spending, that all is well. But when you fall short, that is a problem. So I just wanted to correct that small detail. And I'm sure folks maybe didn't even stand out, but I wanted to correct the record. But yeah, I think it's very notable to call out Howard Marks. He came out. Howard Marks is a legendary value investor, really on the credit side, meaning bonds, not more so than stocks. But as has oftentimes been the cliche, bond investors are in many ways historically the smartest guys and gals in the room, because bonds really get to the essence of the money system, and it's a much bigger market than equity markets globally. Now, of course, central banks have manipulated and corrupted bond markets, but we're getting back to a credit market, bond market that's a little bit more free functioning. But anyways, Howard Marks came out with, he's been in the market since 1969, I think his career started. So he's one of the legends, and perhaps a more modest legend than some of the ones that are always headline grabbing. Very, very humble guy. But he came out with a market comment, I think yesterday or the day before, basically saying that he thinks we're on the embarking on really the only third major sea change in his whole career as an investment strategist. And just by context, the first two that he talked about was back in the 70s, early in his career, there was a sea change in which investors started to look at, prior to that, people would avoid risky assets altogether. There was no price that would be compelling enough to tempt investors to kind of take on risk so long as they were compensated. In the early 70s into the 80s, the concept of pricing risk became more prevalent. And of course, it's not a perfect pricing because we've seen major blowups. But the idea that you can buy, you know, riskier investments so long as the price is attractive enough to get compensated for it. And that's been our big beef here at New Harbor for many years, is that in most assets these last several years, the price has been utterly overvalued relative to the risks, at least from a historical standpoint. And this is where you might say valuations ultimately matter. So that was the first sea change that he talked about. The second was really what we have seen for the last 40 years, a declining interest rate market. If you look at a chart of 10-year treasury yields or even federal fund target rates over the last 40 years, they essentially have done nothing but go down. Okay. And I think he said 60 or maybe even higher than that of all market gains over that time can be attributable to the declining interest rate environment. And that gets us to what he sees right now as us embarking on a new regime or new sea change, where there is likely no way in heck we can expect the kind of tailwind of low and declining interest rates over the next 20, 40 years that we saw over the last 40 years. So he projects that we'll likely see persistently higher interest rates, maybe settling in the 2-4% range. He ascribes almost zero probability we go back down to a zero interest rate environment like we saw the last decade. But he also projects stubbornly high inflation. So maybe to in a word, say the Fed's long 2% target maybe is a pipe dream in his assessment. All to say is he thinks, to sum it up, he thinks the strategies that have worked over the last decade, two decades, maybe even the last four decades, are likely to be not the strategies that work over the next coming decades. And this ties into, if folks saw the breakout video that Mike and I did with you last week, Adam, where we talked about, and this is playing off of some of Felix Zuloff's comments, that, you know, the passive strategies, the 60-40 pie chart, you know, buy and hold, that have worked so well over the last 40 years generally, are likely to be utterly disappointing in the coming decade or more. And we did we by way of example showed a chart of the S&P 500 in the late 60s to early 80s, where you saw the index essentially go nowhere, but there definitely were tradable rallies of nearly a doubling in a couple instances over that time frame, but followed by massive losses. So a very tactical, hands-on, very selective investment approach is likely to be important. Picking sectors, you know, Luke's reference to a massive sector rotation, we couldn't agree more. And we think it's going to go back to looking at things that are fair valuations, things like some of the resource sectors, things like precious metal mining, which we think is a very low sector, emerging market stocks, low valuations relative. You know, I can go on and on, but I really encourage folks to seek out that investor letter by Howard Marks. There's some headline, you know, stories on the media that give the snippets from that. And Adam, I would encourage you, if you can get Howard Marks as a guest, I think you would have a fabulous conversation. He's a really insightful guy.
He's on the target list. And I really appreciate you bringing him up here and summarizing his thoughts here for folks. If we can get a link to that investor letter, folks, I'll put it in the description to this video below. So thanks for bringing that up, John. It's just yet another highly seasoned voice that is joining the chorus of many that we've had on this program here, underscoring the switch from passive to active that you just mentioned there. Folks, if you want a deeper dive into that discussion, as John referenced last week, the guys from New Harbor here and I really dug into that topic deeply. So I won't do it here, but I will put up a link to the video right here for you. But the key takeaway from that, folks, is unless you already are a highly experienced active investor, which most people haven't been because they haven't had to be over the past 10 to 15 years because of these tailwinds that we've had at the back of the market, where it's just inexorably risen every year and you could basically close your eyes and pick an ETF and you've done fine. That does not seem to be the future that we're heading into here. So unless you are yourself an experienced active investor, you need to make sure that whomever you're working with from an advisory standpoint has that skill set, and a lot of them don't. We talked about this in depth last week, but it's again because they haven't had to. You know, that understandably, most of today's financial advisors have grown up in a market with that tailwind at their back, and all the musculature and experience that they've developed has been riding that trend because that is what made them and their clients money. Now there's a sea change, to steal from Howard Marks. And these guys basically have the exact wrong experience set to navigate you through, you know, the new environment ahead. So, look, if your advisor has those skills, great, stick with them. They're a rarity; they're very valuable. If not, you know, consider talking with one of the advisors that Wealthion endorses. I'll give you the link at the end of this video here. But I just really want to underscore that point, because we are basically entering an era that's going to require a very different playbook than retail investors and professional financial advisors have been using. All right. So, you know, ignore that sea change at your peril. Mike, coming back to you as we just begin to wrap up here. I know that you guys are big on natural resources. Precious metals are one of the biggest holdings that you guys have, precious metals and the mining companies. I'm assuming that, you know, Luke's comments about gold in general, you know, probably rang true to your ears. But I'm just curious if you have any commentary on his thoughts there about the potential, which he says actually is inevitable, that eventually oil will be priced in gold, and that could cause a dramatic revaluation for gold.
I think absolutely that's likely to happen. He talks about oil for gold being an inevitability. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, gold is one of the assets that's been shown to hold purchasing power versus you know, many other things. But certainly, you know, in terms of the oil producing nations, they're looking for, they want to receive value, obviously, for the energy that they sell, and receiving gold for it makes absolute sense. And I think that if that were to happen, gold would be priced dramatically higher. From a technical perspective, gold looks very good here. We would talk about it almost every week. There's been a giant cup and handle basing formation and a couple fake outs too, and breakout from the handle to the upside of that basing formation failed last year, a year and a half ago, and then we broke to the downside and that failed, and we're back to the middle again, back to the apex of that bullish triangle right at 1820 or so. And then gold is trading at 1822 right now, and you know, we've been saying look for that 1820 level, because if it gets back there, then both fake outs, both the upside breakout and fake out and the downside breakout and fake out, will have proven to be false. And so it's kind of really taking people for a ride, and we're right back to that decision point. So if we can see gold really break out again to the upside from here, this decision point, this could be the time that it really runs. And the technicals say it should run to around 2,500 or so. So yeah, we like the miners. We think they're very undervalued. Like John, I think, mentioned earlier, we like the physical metal. And whether or not oil gets repriced in gold or gold for oil happens, we think that gold will do well. If gold for oil does happen, gold will do phenomenal. So just a small allocation of 5 to 10% of your investable assets in physical gold and silver is a good idea, in our opinion. And it's a good diversifier, and it should do very well. And you know, again, the technicals look very timely here. So we would consider adding it or taking a look at your allocation and rebalancing it.
All right. You know, it's going to be interesting. You know, in the immediate term, it seems that every time the Federal Reserve opens its mouth, this is a long, you know, track record. It seems to always, no matter what happens with other assets, it always seems to punch the precious metals right in the face. We're going to find out in just a couple minutes if that happens again today or not. So by the time folks are watching this, they'll know. Also, you know, Felix and Luke, I think, you know, both have said, hey, you know, all assets are probably not going to do so hot in Q1 as we have sort of more of the same going on with, you know, slowing economy, potentially rates going back up a bit. So, you know, who knows? We'll see what's going to happen in the next quarter or so. And maybe they don't quite catch fire in that time frame for the reasons that Luke and Felix have mentioned. If so, I imagine you guys would say that's a good time to be dollar cost averaging in if you haven't yet. And then, of course, both Felix and Luke, and, you know, again, nobody has a complete crystal ball. But if their probabilities prove correct, you know, there could be some big event around into Q1, into Q2 that forces a Fed pivot. And we would expect precious metals to be one of the asset classes that reacts more immediately to that news than others. Right, Mike?
I would think so, you know, and you talked a little bit before about conventional financial advice. Conventional financial advice is not going to tell you to hold real things like gold and silver. And we've heard stories of people we've talked to that have advisors that have said things like, well, you can't go down to the grocery store and buy a loaf of bread with gold. I guess that's technically true, but you really can't buy a loaf of bread with a share of Apple stock either. You know, so I mean, there's really this lack of acceptance in the general community. Don't listen to that. Listen to yourself. And I'm not saying that we're right. I can't guarantee that either. But it just makes sense. Gold and silver have been money for thousands of years. And we're not saying put 100% of what you've got into it. We're saying put 5 or 10% of your investable assets into it. And again, we're right at that level where technically it looks great. And any one of these other catalysts happen, it will do very well. And so this is not about being a gold bug or being extreme. It's a very good asset to diversify with. And you know, we like it a lot.
All right, we're going to have to start wrapping up here. One thing I'd like to talk with you guys about maybe next time is Tesla. Tesla was the wonder stock of the whole, you know, hyper growth tech movement. The stock hit an all-time high of about $380 a share, and this is after many splits, back in November of last year. It's now down to below 160 as of the time that we're talking here. So it's lost a lot of its value. And we had talked a few weeks ago after I'd interviewed David Trainer about zombie companies. And he was bringing up Tesla as a potential trigger, that enough weakness in Tesla, because so much speculative capital has gone into that stock. If enough of that gets vaporized, then that could start a cascade of losses across kind of the zombie swath of U.S. corporations. I just think it's something to keep our eye on. I would love to get your guys' thoughts about that. I just want to sort of pre-sell that discussion here. John, just heading back to you, I'll give you the last word here as we wrap up. Again, just a reminder, we are just a couple of weeks away from the end of the year. Anything you might want to remind folks to do in the remaining days of the year would be great. And just again, a reminder, you guys are open through the holiday season if folks want to have discussions about either wrapping up the things they need to get done before the end of the year or want to talk to you about getting on a solid footing for 2023, correct?
Yeah, so year end always brings to mind tax planning because that's how our tax year is structured. It's a calendar year tax year. So things like managing or harvesting unrealized losses in a thoughtful way, especially if you have gains on the books and you want to avoid or defer or diminish the amount of capital gains taxes you might have. You know, thinking about, so obviously if folks have required distributions they have to take from their IRAs and inherited IRAs, absolutely get those done before year end because there's a pretty hefty penalty for under withdrawing, but also consider over withdrawing, essentially taking elective distributions from an IRA, especially if, for example, you're in a year where your income, reported income, is going to be lower than you might expect in a future year. Perhaps you were in transition or lost a job. You know, we do think, and this ties into the fiscal situation we touched upon earlier in this video, and Luke talked heavily about, something's got to give. The notion of higher tax rates in the future is a very real possibility to plug the hole, if you will. So you know, taking elective distributions now when tax rates are quite possibly quite favorable to where they're going. Absolutely. These are all things you should think about doing. In terms of I'm sorry, Adam, there was another part of that question you asked me. Just quickly remind me what it was. And
that you guys are open.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we absolutely are. We pride ourselves at being accessible. You know, most of our clients and prospects, I think, would tell you they very rarely will get a voicemail or a non-human during working hours. You know, we do value balance, work-life balance, as best as we can get it. So I think markets are closed the day after Christmas. Christmas falls on a Sunday. So the 26th of December, I believe, is a market holiday. So we're just going to not be at the office that day. So please, folks, appreciate that. We'll appreciate that downtime as well for that day. But otherwise, we're open. We're available. We're available to do trades that need to be done, but also have conversations with folks about their situation. And we have a team to do that. That's why we have a team. We all work together on clients' behalf, and we'll make sure we're accessible.
Great. All right. Well, look, folks, highly recommend that you follow
you know, the year-end best practices that John mentioned, either yourself with your existing advisor, or if you'd like some help, reach out to the team there at New Harbor. To do that, just go to wealthion.com, fill out the short form there. We'll connect you with one of our financial advisors based upon what you tell us your priorities are. And just as a reminder, those are free consultations. They don't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these guys. We just offer it as a free public service to help people get as prepared as possible for the crazy type of year that we think may be lying ahead of us, given what Luke and I just talked about. So if you haven't done that yet, go ahead and do it. All right, folks, and happy holidays to everybody. Hope everybody's looking at great times with family, friends, maybe some wonderful experiences if you're going to go travel. If you enjoy these great discussions we have with folks like Luke Grohman, if you'd like to see Luke back on the channel, other great names like him, please do me a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And whatever happens over the remaining couple weeks of this year, we'll certainly be deconstructing whatever the Fed announces in the next couple minutes when John and Mike are on here with me next week. We will be doing it here on this channel for you and hope you join us then. John and Mike, thanks so much for joining me again for another week. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Enjoyed it once again, Adam. Thanks so much. We'll see you next week.
As always, Adam, thanks for keeping us on our toes. Great conversation with you always, and we look forward to the next one.
If you'd like to schedule a consultation with one of the financial advisors at New Harbor Financial, simply go to wealthion.com. These consultations are completely free, and there are no strings attached. The good folks at New Harbor will simply answer any questions you have about your investment goals or your portfolio and give you their best advice given their latest market outlook. They're willing to do this because they care about protecting people's wealth, and because Wealthion has connected them with so many thoughtful investors just like you over the past decade. We started doing this because so many people have approached us in frustration, looking for a solution because they're feeling out of alignment or downright ridiculed by the standard financial advisors who have been managing their money. You know the type. The kind that just pushes all of your money into the market, scoffs at the idea of owning gold, and when you bring up concerns about the market's sky-high valuations, they say, "Don't worry, the market will always take care of you." For many of the reasons discussed in today's video, we think this is one of the most challenging and treacherous times in history for investing. We strongly believe that today's investors are best served working in partnership with a conscientious professional financial advisor who understands the risks in play. Now, we're agnostic which professional advisor you work with, as long as they're good. If you're already working with one, that's fantastic. Stick with them. But if you don't, or are having trouble finding one you respect or trust, then consider talking to John and Mike and the team at New Harbor. Now, for those about to ask, yes, there's a business relationship between Wealthion and New Harbor, which we've put in place to make sure everything is handled according to SEC regulations. All the details on this are clearly provided on the Wealthion.com website. Also, it's important to note that New Harbor is able to work with U.S. citizens, green card holders, and those with existing assets in the USA. But for regulatory reasons, they aren't able to take on non-U.S. clients. All right, with all that said, if you'd like some insight and guidance on how to protect your wealth during this unprecedented time in the markets, go to wealthion.com to schedule your free consultation with the good folks at New Harbor. Thanks for watching.